Today comes from 2 Kings chapter 5, beginning at verse 1. Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Aram, was a great man and in high favor with his master, because by him the Lord had given victory to Aram. The man, though a mighty warrior, suffered from leprosy. Now the Arameans, on one of their raids, had taken a young girl captive from the land of Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my lord were with the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." So Naaman went in and told his lord just what the girl from the land of Israel had said. And the king of Aram said, "Go then, and I will send along a letter to the king of Israel." He went, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of garments. He brought the letter to the king of Israel, which read, "When this letter reaches you, know that I have sent to you my servant Naaman, that you may cure him of his leprosy." When the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes and said, "Am I God to give death or life that this man sends word to me to cure a man of his leprosy? Just look and see how he is trying to pick a quarrel with me." But when Elijah, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had tore his clothes, he sent a message to the king. "Why have you torn your clothes? Let him come to me that he may learn that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman came with his horses and chariots and halted at the entrance of Elijah's house. Elijah sent a messenger to him, saying, "Go, wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored, and you shall be clean." But Naaman became angry and went away, saying, "I thought that for me he would surely come out and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, and would wave his hand over the spot and cure the leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean?" He turned and went away in a rage. But his servants approached and said to him, "Father, if the prophet had commanded you to do something difficult, would you not have done it? How much more when all he said to you was, 'Wash and be clean'?" So he went down and immersed himself 7 times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God. His flesh was restored, like the flesh of a young boy, and he was clean. Then he returned to the man of God, he and all his company. He came and stood before him and said, "Now I know that there is no God in all the earth except in Israel. Please accept a present from your servant." But he said, "As the Lord lives, whom I serve, I will accept nothing." He urged him to accept, but he refused. Then Naaman said, "If not, please let 2 mule loads of earth be given to your servant, for your servant will no longer offer burnt offerings or sacrifices to any god except the Lord. But may the Lord pardon your servant on one account. When my master goes into the house of Ramon to worship there, leaning on my arm, and I bow down in the house of Ramon, when I do bow down in the house of Ramon, may the Lord pardon your servant on this one account." He said to him, "Go in peace." The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Well, welcome again to worship. Today we're continuing in this sermon series that we've been doing this fall entitled Forgotten Tales of the OT. And if you're new with us today, what we've been doing in this series is taking a look at some of those lesser known stories from the Old Testament that don't always get a lot of attention. And in this series we've been kind of jumping around quite a bit, covering a lot of ground. We went from the book of Genesis to Exodus to then Numbers to Joshua to 1 Samuel last week. But for the next several weeks, we're going to be sticking around in the book of 2 Kings. Not only that, but we'll be staying with the same figure for 3 weeks in a row here. You know, one of the prophets that people often know pretty well from the Bible is the prophet Elijah. All right, there's the well-known story of Elijah battling the prophets of Baal and calling down fire from heaven to consume his sacrifice to God. And, of course, the famous story of Elijah being taken up to heaven on a chariot of fire. But one figure that people often don't know as well is Elijah's disciple, his successor, Elisha. That's right, there's both an Elijah and an Elisha. And there are some great, often overlooked stories involving Elisha in 2 Kings, and this is where we'll be focusing for the next few weeks. Now, before we get into this story today, let me again set the historical context of where this story happens in Israel's history. The people of Israel they've left slavery in Egypt. They've settled in the promised land, and now we're in the time of kings in Israel's history. The most famous king, of course, is King David, who's the second king. Well, today's story takes place during the reign of King Jehoram, who is the 12th king of Israel. And during this time period, the nation of Aram, also known as Syria, was one of Israel's main enemies. Now, when 2 Kings, from 2 Kings chapter 2 to chapter 8, we have one story after another about Elijah. But interestingly enough, in today's story, the main character, it's not Elisha, but instead it's a man named Naaman, who's actually from Aram, from the enemy of Israel. And so let's look again at this, at verse 1 here, how this story begins. It says this: Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Aram, was a great man and in high favor with his master, because by him the Lord had given victory to Aram. The man, though, a mighty warrior, suffered from leprosy. Right, so we see right away here that Naaman, he's not just an Aramean, he is the commander of the army of Aram. But not only that, we're told that he's a great man. He's in high favor with his master, the king, because it says, by him the Lord had given victory to Aram. Right? That's interesting. Apparently, you know, God's not only controlling events in Israel, he's controlling events in Aram too. In fact, he's actually giving victory to Aram, probably over Israel. Right? So God's not just the God of one territory or one people, he's the God of all nations, the God of all people. And God has plans for Aram. He has plans for Naaman. Now, as we see here, because of God, Naaman, he's really kind of at the top of his game. Right? He's a great general. He's a mighty warrior. He's famous in Syria. He's rich. He's got everything going for him except one big thing. He has leprosy, this terrible skin disease. And so understand his situation. No matter how many great things he has accomplished in his life, he's still lacking something enormous, his health. And with all the resources, the power, the status he has, there's nothing he can do to acquire the healing he needs. And here's what we're going to find. This need in his life is eventually what drives him to seek out the God of Israel. And you know, here's the reality. For most people, the situation is similar. Right, most of us don't earnestly seek for God in our lives until we first get that kind of that wake-up call that we can't be self-sufficient. No matter how great of a life we're able to build for ourselves, something will always come in to ruin it. We'll always find some gaping need in our lives that we can't fulfill on our own. Right? For Naaman, his life was great, but he had leprosy. And each of us will encounter that, you know, but he had sort of thing. But he got sick, but her mother died, but life lost meaning, but the addiction got too out of control, but the business went under, but the depression wouldn't go away. We'll all find that there are needs in our lives we can't deal with, and no matter what earthly remedy we try, we can't fix it. And hopefully when the time comes for you, you have someone in your life, like Naaman had, who points you to the one hope, the one cure, the one source of life, to God. And so look at who this person is for Naaman. It says this: Now the Arameans, on one of their raids, had taken a young girl captive from the land of Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my lord were with the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." Now this might be maybe the most astounding part of this whole story. Right, eventually there's this girl in Naaman's house who tells him about Elijah the prophet and what he can do. But think for a minute about this girl's situation. Right, this Israelite girl, probably 10, 13 years old, was taken captive by the Arameans on a raid and made a slave in Naaman's house to serve his wife. And, you know, the rest of her family might have been killed in that raid. They might have been sold off into slavery themselves to others. And so she's really at the kind of the very bottom of Aramean society. She's the wrong race. She's a slave. She's a woman. She's young. Everything has been taken from her, and now her life is at a dead end. And the person who's probably most responsible for all this is likely Naaman, right, who was the commander of the army, maybe led this raid. And think about this, you know, if you were in her shoes, how would you respond when you hear about Naaman's leprosy, right? Maybe, ha, right, good. Serves him right. I can't wait to see another finger fall off. Or think of the satisfaction you may get knowing that you know how Naaman can be healed, but you're not going to share it. His life is in your hands. But that's not how this girl responds. Instead, she says, if only my master knew about Elijah. Right? There's kind of seems like love there, compassion, maybe even longing. Right? Such forgiveness she displays. She has her enemy's life in her hands and she chooses to save him. And that sounds a lot like someone else we know, of course. That sounds like Jesus. We beat him, rejected him, tortured him, killed him, and instead of choosing revenge, he chooses to save us. And so Naaman takes this girl's words to heart, and he seeks out healing in Israel. But we find out there's kind of a mix-up that happens along the way. Naaman tells his king that he wants to go to Israel to be healed. So the king of Aram sends Naaman to the king of Israel with a letter and says, please cure Naaman. And you see, you know, in pagan culture, like in Aram, religion and the state, they're really tied together. The king of a certain area would have his own gods, and he would employ his own priests, his own prophets to serve those gods. And so that's why he writes this letter to the king, right? He assumes that Elijah works for him. But that's not how it works in Israel. The real prophets don't work for the king, they work for God. They're chosen by God. And oftentimes they spoke against what the king was doing, and that's true here. The king of Israel was a guy named Jehoram, and Jehoram did what was evil in the eyes of God. And so Elijah did not speak kindly of him. And so the king of Israel gets this letter and reads it as a threat. Heal Naam or else we're coming for you. And Jehoram is distraught. He can't heal Naaman. But fortunately, Elijah hears of this, and he tells the king in verse 8, let him come to me that he may learn that there is a prophet in Israel. And so Naaman goes to Elijah's house. But I want you to notice how he arrives. Verse 5 tells us that he came with 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of garments. Now, one talent of silver is about 75 pounds, right? So 10 talents is 750 pounds of silver. Then he has 6,000 shekels of gold, which would have been about 100, 150 pounds of gold, right? So we're talking about a king's ransom that Naaman brings. And it's clear what he's trying to do here. He has come to buy a miracle for himself. He assumes that in order to get something from Israel's God, he first needs to give something. Along with that, we're also told that he arrives at Elijah's house with horses, with chariots. He has come with a large military retinue. In other words, he's coming to show Elijah how great he is as a man. He's powerful. He's wealthy. He's an important man who is worthy to be received by Elijah and healed. But look at what happens in verse 9. So Naaman came with his horses and chariots and halted at the entrance of Elijah's house. Elijah sent a messenger to him saying, go wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored, and you shall be clean. But Naaman became angry and went away saying, I thought that for me he would surely come out and stand and call in the name of the Lord his God, and would wave his hand over the spot and cure the leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean? He turned and went away in a rage. Right, so Naaman, with all his wealth and his pomp and circumstance, goes and he shows himself at Elijah's house. And what does Elijah do? He doesn't come out. Right, he's just chilling on the couch, doesn't get up. Instead, he sends a messenger out to Naaman with a few instructions. And Naaman can't believe this. Right, he assumed Elijah would come out eager to serve him, to heal such a great man. And then Elijah, this powerful prophet, this miracle worker, would perform this great ritual and call upon God and wave his hand over his leprosy and he'd be healed. But Elijah sends out a messenger instead who says, go wash in the Jordan 7 times. And you have to understand as well, the Jordan River, it's not really an impressive river, relatively small, just maybe 40 to 50 feet across in a few spots, just a few feet deep in certain places. It's often described as being muddy, kind of brown and murky water. So Naaman is basically been told to go wash in a muddy creek. And he doesn't understand this. Nothing about the Jordan communicates divine healing power. He wants something more suited to his rank, and he's come to earn his healing. He can pay for better. He wants the touch. He wants the voice of the great, powerful prophet. And so he says, no, I'm not doing that. But then it's another servant who shows him the way and talks some sense into him. He says, if the prophet had commanded you to do something difficult, would you not have done it? Right? He's not asking much, just wash and be clean. And so Naaman does it, and he's healed. And not only that, but it says his flesh was restored like the flesh of a young boy, right? So God kind of went above and beyond. Now he's got the skin, you know, as smooth as a baby's bottom, right? And then look at Naaman's response in verse 15. Then he returned to the man of God, he and all his company. He came and stood before him and said, now I know that there is no God in all the earth except in Israel. Please accept a present from your servant. But he said, as the Lord lives, whom I serve, I will accept nothing. He urged him to accept, but he refused. Right? So we see this profound change in Naaman. Not only has he been healed in body, but his heart, his mind has undergone a transformation as well. And what Naaman says here, it's quite astonishing. Again, Naaman comes from a pagan culture where they believed in the existence of many gods. We call this polytheism. Poly means many. And so after this miraculous healing, we would expect Naaman to say, now I know that the God of Israel is the greatest God of all the gods in all the earth. But that's not what Naaman says. Instead, he says, now I know that there is no God in all the earth except in Israel. Right before Naaman goes under the water, he's a polytheist. But when he comes up from the water, he's a monotheist. He believes in only one God now. And what a change. And it's because he knows how miraculous this healing is. No other God can do this. There's no ritual that happens. Elijah wasn't even there to speak the words, wave his hands. He's all by himself in a muddy river. It had to be God. And he thinks, if this is what the God of Israel can do, no one else compares. In fact, no other God is even God. There's only one true God who rules over all things. Right? What a confession by Naaman. What Naaman had also come to understand is that God is the only solution to his problem. His rank, his wealth, his strength, his prestige, none of that was going to help him. Even the touch of Elijah wasn't going to help him. It was only God. God was his only hope all along. And we have to realize the same thing. Our only hope is God and his son Jesus. Right? As the song goes, what can wash away my sin? Nothing but the blood of Jesus. Who can make me whole again? Nothing but the blood of Jesus. Right? Whatever is going on in your life, whatever you're lacking, however you're hurting, however you're stuck, whatever mistakes you have made, your only hope is Jesus. Jesus says this in Matthew 11. Come to me, all that you are weary and carrying heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Or Peter says this in Acts 4. There is salvation in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given among mortals by which we must be saved. The other thing that Naaman learned was that the God of Israel didn't do business the way he thought he did. Right? God's not transactional. You can't pay God. You can't earn your salvation or your healing. Instead, he learned that the God of Israel is a God of grace. God gives to us lavishly out of his grace, out of his love, out of trust and faith. We serve a gracious God, right? We can't earn it, but we can humbly ask for healing, for forgiveness, for salvation. Now, there's one last part of the story I want to share with you. Naaman's body's been transformed. His heart and mind have been transformed. And then the last thing we see is that his life will also be transformed by God. He tells Elijah, if I can't give you any gift, at least let me take 2 mule loads of earth, of dirt, from this place and take it back home with me. Right? The assumption is that he's gonna lay this dirt down at his home and build an altar on top of it there to God. Right? He thinks that the God of Israel can only really be worshipped in Israel, and so he builds kind of a mini Israel in Syria so that he can offer sacrifices to God in Israel's soil. But then he also has a request for Elijah. He says, I will never offer a sacrifice to any other God but the God of Israel, but please pardon me for something that might happen. Look at verse 18. It says this, but may the Lord pardon your servant on one account when my master goes into the house of Ramon to worship there, leaning on my arm, and I bow down in the house of Ramon. When I bow down in the house of Ramon, may the Lord pardon your servant on this one account. And he said to him, go in peace. Right, so Naaman is saying, you know, when I help my king back in Aram, go into the temple to worship his God, and I need to bow down to help him to his knees, would you pardon me for what looks like an act of worship by me to another God? Now, you think that Elijah would say no, right? The first commandment says, you shall have no other gods before me. But instead, Elijah says, go in peace. Yes, God will allow this. And the question is, why? Why would God allow this? Well, think about this now. You know, Naaman didn't say, Elijah, you know, I want to stay with you here in Israel and follow God here. No, instead, he says, I'm going to go back to my life in this pagan culture. But this time when he goes back, he wants to bring God with him. He's not going to flee his pagan culture. Instead, he wants to live out his faith within it. And maybe he hopes to one day transform it. And I'm sure he will tell everyone what the God of Israel did for him, and they will see him worshiping the God of Israel. But he knows this transformation is not going to happen overnight. Right? They believe in other gods. And this is where he has to live. And his vocation as a general of Syria necessitates that he goes into the temple. And so he says, I'm trying to find a balance here. And God shows him grace in this. He knows Naaman's heart. God's not easily confused. He knows who you're truly worshiping. And he approves of Naaman's desire to go back to his home and his culture and make God the center of his life back in that context. And this is, again, just a great lesson for us. Right? How can you take God and make him the center of your life in every part of the context and the culture that you live in? What would it look like to take him into the culture of your workplace? Or to make him central in your home with your family? What would it look like to take him into the culture of your school? Or think about this, what would it look like to take him with you to the bar or to the motorcycle rally or the music festival or the hunting shack? And here's the hard part, what would it look like to have him transform that sphere of your life? We serve a great and awesome God. There is no other God in all the universe except him. He alone is our healer, our savior, our hope, and our source of all goodness in life. And so may each of us strive to put him at the center of our lives. Let's pray.